How have the Jews embraced other cultures, and how have these interactions shaped their history? Simon Schammel will join us to talk about his new book, The Story of the Jews.
I think empirically the Jews, including very Orthodox Jews, have never, ever been separate from the world in which they've been planted, unless they've been forced to be.
What else are you doing while listening to this podcast? Bridget Schulte will be here to talk about her new book, Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time.
Why am I baking these cupcakes at 2 a.m? And, you know, why am I bringing the Thanksgiving turkey? Why am I here at 10 a.m. laminating for all of the teachers when I really should be at work?
Julie Bosman will be here with Notes from the Field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
I have set before you life and death, blessing and a curse. Therefore, choose life. What ties us together is a story. A story kept in our heads and hearts.
We told our story to survive. We are our story.
Simon Schammel has a new book, The Story of the Jews, Finding the Words, 1000 BC to 1492 AD. He joins us now. Hi, Simon.
Hello, Pamela.
So you have told, I suppose, what we can consider half the story in this book, right? This is a planned two-volume project?
Yeah, chronologically it's half the story, but I've discovered to my amazement that Jews get around a bit in the modern world, so there is a lot more to write. So I don't guarantee for everybody's bookshelf that the two volumes will be of equal girth, the second one looking a little bit fatter.
So possibly a third volume?
No, we mustn't even breathe a word of that.
Okay.
My publishers will commit collective suicide.
All right.
There will only be two volumes.
And you, of course, have written on a very wide-ranging topics, including one of my favorite books, The Embarrassment of Riches.
Thank you.
Interpretation of Dutch culture in the Golden Age. What made you decide to write a history of the Jews?
Well, I have actually written. I wrote a possibly deservedly forgotten book about Palestine and the Rothschilds a long time ago, and it's always been a kind of major preoccupation of mine. Someone who grew up with Jewish history as the first history, you know, I was aware of in the Bible. So it's always been lingering there, but I was kind of, as the preface of the book explained, when I was offered the chance to complete the half-finished work of a very great, austere Anglo-Jewish historian, Cecil Roth, I couldn't quite do it. It wasn't just that I definitely wasn't competent to do it 40 years ago, but I hadn't quite found the right voice. And when researching the book now, I realized that, you know, what had changed a lot was the archaeology, the art history. Jewish art history used to be an oxymoron. No longer. We now realize that it's a central part in the life of Judaism, the second commandment notwithstanding.
Right.
And, you know, you as someone who likes The Embarrassment of Riches know I like this kind of thieving magpie approach, which uses images and objects and buildings. And that seemed to me very important now, not just a pastime, but actually part of the explanatory apparatus of how a Jewish identity came into existence. So I felt a bit easier with that. Then there's the sort of sententiously civic part of it, I think, without making it too kind of sanctimonious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if there's one thing other than the slow death of the planet that turns out to be the most horribly intractable issue of all now for our own generation, it's the difficulty of people of different beliefs sharing the same living space without the obligation to kill each other. And the Jews have a very urgent, not the only story, not unique in suffering the consequences of failing to solve that problem, but they do have a special story to tell about it.
And you have a very interesting and different from sort of many people's accepted views of the Jewish people point of view here in terms of Jewish pluralism. Does the idea of Jews as being this sort of self-contained, insular group of people hold?
Well, I think with the caveat that, you know, making the division between Jews and non-Jews a boundary that's more porous, I keep on having to correct for saying, well, this is what I'd like to be the case, you know. So I, both in the television series and in the book, I'm really careful to guard against fashionable comfort. Nonetheless, I think empirically the Jews, including very Orthodox Jews, have never, ever been separate from the world in which they've been planted, unless they've been forced to be. I mean, one case in point that I deal with in a book is this fantastic kind of city from late antiquity called Sepphoris, or Tzipori in Hebrew, in Galilee, just close to Nazareth, which has these ravishing, extraordinary mosaics on a surviving 5th century AD synagogue floor. This looks, to all intents and purposes, like a classical city, and in it were indeed Greeks and Romans and Aramean Syrians, but it was not only dominantly a Jewish city, but it was the place where the Mishnah, the first oral code of the law, was actually redacted and started to be edited. So when you see all this extraordinary kind of classical, you know, the apparatus of a classical culture, you're not looking at a kind of very relaxed, fashionably pluralist reform. You're looking at a religious Jewish city. And this is a startling fact, and this gave me confidence to say this is most often the case. I mean, the Venice ghetto, another case, is a ghetto. The gates and bridges are locked at night, but anyone comes and goes during the day, unlike the Roman ghetto, I have to say. I don't want to err on the side of wishful thinking if it's going to compromise the two true core of Judaism, but I don't think it does.
You mentioned TV. You did this book alongside a documentary on the BBC, now airing on PBS. Which came first, or were these two projects considered together from the beginning?
Well, yes. I mean, I always thought of it as I do these two projects the same. What you don't do, I've done enough of these documentaries to know that what you don't do is write a book and hand it to a production team and say, right, go and film that. I, for better or worse, you know, write the script like a screenplay with the shots on the left. This is an interesting thing for book review readers, I think. There are two completely different sides of your brain. The logistical facts are that you start writing as a book, and then you go and film, and you have to do a completely different kind of writing. Even for me, succinct, economic, because if you're describing any kind of atmospherics, the camera's doing that for you. But the book, by contrast, gives you all the expansiveness, all the complications, all the nuances. It gives you characters, actually, like Licoricia of Winchester, the great and ferocious money-lending Jewess, and many others who you can stay with. You know, that's still the great glory of the book. You can pace the extent to which the reader can remain with the character and their story. And when you deploy an argument, when you pull back from an argument to another piece of storytelling, if you've got the stamina for it, it's either a bonus or a double burden, and I've always regarded it as a bonus. They kind of nourish each other, the two kinds of writing, but they're very different animals.
Really. So the book was entirely written before you started working on
it? No, I wish. No, I mean, that would be perfect, wouldn't it? It just varies from project to project, and it was about half written, I have to say.
So did some of it develop alongside each other? I mean, part of what you did, obviously, is a lot of on-site research going through archives, and I imagine that can be kind of boring to film, but it could be exciting if you were to discover something and sort of have that filmed in the moment of discovery.
Yes, I mean, I think, well, you know, when I was working on the wonderful medieval repository in Egypt, the Cairo Geniza, which, you know, does a drive-by in the program, but a very nice drive-by. There were particular things I found during the research. I mean, I didn't discover them, but they were there wonderfully, like the little child's alphabet book, which has a doodle of the camel. Now, the doodle of the camel is a picture in the book, actually, but it's a lovely little sequence with the brilliant curator Ben Althwaite in the film. But that's what I was incredibly struck by in the Cairo Geniza, as I spend a bit, possibly too much time in the book, is the kind of fabulous dandy of the Jewish community in Cairo, both male and women. It was quite astonishing to me to find this man who is ordering a flame-colored costume for the Day of Atonement, when you're supposed to all be dressed in white with an occasional accent of black. Very often what happens is you write, and then you go film, and then you actually see something that you hadn't noticed when you're doing the research. So you go back to the book, but you do have to put on your book writer's hat again.
Right. Right.
I mean, they're making it sound very, very staccato and neurotic. In fact, it's a lot of fun, actually. But it is weirdly schizophrenic as a literary existence.
Do you find yourself reenacting that moment of initial discovery, or, you know?
No, I mean, I think actually you just take things from something you've seen on a recce, on a reconnaissance, and then you kind of internalize it and digest it and recontextualize it and weave it into the fabric of the story as proper book story. Does that sound confusing? It probably is to me.
No, but now our listeners will go and watch the program and read the book and work it all out for you.
It sounds horribly self-interested, which of course it is, actually.
So because of the way you told this history through all of these objects and these stories, I imagine there was an enormous amount of travel involved. Where did you go to do the research for the book?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, the first thing, to be absolutely honest, of course, one goes to one's computer, you know, because actually so much phenomenal archive is available on a computer. Mm-hmm. But then you also, you know, you go to the British Library and you go to the Bodleian and go to a magnificent Columbia Library. I don't pretend that I've actually literally unearthed primary sources in Hebrew or Ladino or something like that, actually. So the book is a synthesis and owes it and a gigantic debt of gratitude to all kinds of scholarship. But for example, you do go to places that you know, and then they become written stories. So I'll give you one instance that these tiny silver amulets. Everybody just walks past them in the Israel Museum from the funeral burial cave at Kesef Hinnom, just on the edge of Jerusalem, have the first inscription, which comes from the Bible that we know of, at the very late 7th century BCE, just towards the end of the reign of King Josiah. And it's written in Hebrew, archaic Hebrew, which is not like the Hebrew that everybody reads now.
Mm-hmm.
That Hebrew is a kind of square form Aramaic. But this is incredibly eloquent, not only that it gives us a sense in which at the time that people did have the Bible before they were written to exile, into Babylonian exile, but also that actually already it was being worn talismanically on their bodies.
Right.
So I walk through the museum with the mind to do something else, and then I find myself standing there for hours, and then go back and reflect, actually, in the American Colony Hotel, as a matter of fact, write that bit up. So it is a weirdly, I don't know, beachcombery kind of research that you have to do, as well as being deeply in libraries.
The book covers almost 2,500 years. How did you decide on your beginning and your end point for this first volume?
Well, the beginning does begin, actually, with this place in Egypt in the 5th century BCE, during the time of the Persian Empire. And that was another... I went to the Brooklyn Museum and talked to wonderful curator Edward Blyberg, who was kind enough to show me some of the papyri. And what struck me, it must strike anybody who knows anything about this extraordinary society, is the first society of, they were called Judeans, the Judean troop, that we know anything about in social detail, because we have these legal documents that were found at the end of the 19th century that are about prenups and dowries and contracts and being Jews or anybody else, property line disputes inevitably. I wanted to have a world of Jews that were not kind of shaped by the great rabbinic tradition or even by the Bible. They're living a kind of parallel life. They have their temple in defiance of Jerusalem rules, which say the only temple that is really a temple, in other words, which has animal sacrifices, must be in Jerusalem. And they observe Passover. Here's a paradox, but they're living in Egypt. Passover's about leaving Egypt.
Right.
There's a lot of staying there. So I wanted, not in order to be cute, but because, you know, most of us Jews, in some sense, live, who are certainly in the diaspora anyway, live exactly such parallel lives. So I describe them in the book, I think, as sort of innocent of the obligation to suffer, not being facetious about that, but having a kind of slightly kind of misty relationship with fierce Bible orthodoxy, but nonetheless, in their names, which are entirely non-Egyptian, non-Greek names, I mean, they're entirely names which have the name of the Jewish God at the end, definitely and clearly they have a kind of Jewish identity. So that, I thought it was nice to, you know, interesting to begin with a world, I think I call it, of happy suburban banality.
Right.
I mean, partly because it seems to me all of Jewish life is a struggle between this extraordinary gift, which is at the same time an issue of having been providentially selected to carry, you know, to carry with us this great tradition of ethical norms, and looking just for an ordinary life. I mean, that's an issue in Israel now. It's the contention between, to use a misleading shorthand, Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, the quest for a regular Joe life and the acceptance that being Jewish is never having just a kind of regular Joe life.
And you end with not exactly a happy moment in Jewish history, 1492.
With the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, which is an incredible trauma. But it also is a great moment of modern creativity, because the Marranos, those who are left behind ostensibly as Christians to avoid the Inquisition, are just about to travel the face of the earth, some of them in search of a place where they can openly practice Judaism. And one of those places will be Italy, and one of those places will be Amsterdam, and one of those places will be England, and in the end, one of those places will be America. So I actually end, you remember the book, with this wonderful kind of Portuguese figure who's openly Jewish called Abraham Zacuto, who is the person who is himself not only a traveler and runs into pirates, capture his ship and so on, but he's the person who provides the astronomical chart by which mariners can actually navigate their latitude accurately, much more accurately than the place. So he's a wonderful mixture of a geographer, a historian of a kind, and his whole Jewish imagination is there, out there, sort of on the rim of the earth, as I describe it. So it's a moment where Jews are packing their bags.
Right.
But even, you know, when we reach for the suitcase, we hope that the next destination will have something happy to offer, not just the next round of calamity.
Okay, well, that gives us much to look forward to. Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thanks very much, Pamela.
That was Simon Shama. He is the author of, most recently, The Story of the Jews, Finding the Words, 1000 BC to 1492 AD, reviewed by Judith Shulowitz in this week's issue of The Book Review. Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field on a subject dear to my heart, the death of bookstores in New York City and especially in Manhattan. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
After that very sorrowful introduction, you wrote a story, page A1, this week about what's happened in Manhattan with bookstores. So for listeners who aren't wandering around desperately in search of an open bookstore, tell us what's gone on here.
The story that I wrote was a look at the bookstore landscape in Manhattan. And if you haven't been paying attention, it might actually be easy to miss. Over the last 6 years, five Barnes & Nobles have closed just in Manhattan. Five Borders stores have closed when the entire chain went bankrupt in 2011. A handful of independent bookstores have closed. And really what you have is a borough that was known for its literary cachet, the home of the publishing industry. And yet, if you walk around, it's actually very difficult to find a bookstore throughout large areas of Manhattan. So the question is, what does that mean for the publishing industry, for people who live in New York, and what is anyone going to do about it, if anything?
And also, you know, what does it mean for New York City, which is the hub of the publishing industry and where so many writers live? I mean, I often find myself excited when I travel to go to bookstores because we don't have them here. It's been obviously independence everywhere from, you know, Human on off of 125th Street in Harlem all the way down to lower Manhattan and some of the little stores that were in the Village that have closed in recent years. And specifically, too, the children's bookstores, which, you know, you can go from 112th Street to 18th Street and not hit a single dedicated children's bookshop.
It's kind of astonishing. I mean, a friend of mine said the other day that who lives on the Upper East Side, and he was desperately trying to find a book to bring to a child's birthday party and really had to scramble and said, I could not find a single bookstore. Now, there are a handful of bookstores on the Upper East Side, but if you're looking for a children's bookstore, it's almost impossible to find. I mean, there are some great ones. There's Books of Wonder downtown. The Bank Street Bookstore, which is in Morningside Heights, is still open, but said a few months ago that it's not going to renew its lease in 2015, that it's desperately looking for a new location. It's essentially being kicked out of its current location, and it's been losing money every year for at least 10 years. So it's really the question of rent in Manhattan and what kind of businesses are left standing. I mean, now you can look at the footprints of some old bookstores and see what's been going in. You can look at the Barnes & Noble near Lincoln Center that closed a few years ago. What went into that space? A Century 21 discount clothing chain. You can look at the Barnes & Noble on Astor Place that closed a few years ago. Now it's a gym. So you, as someone who lives in Manhattan, you really have to look around and say, you know, what do we want? Do we want an Upper West Side that's full of banks that are essentially just advertisements for the companies after 6 o'clock when they close? You know, for people who have lived in Manhattan for a really long time, I talked to Robert Caro, the great historian who is a lifelong New Yorker who lives on Central Park West. And, you know, we talked for a long time about what this all means. And he said that it's just completely disheartening. It's depressing. And he feels that, if I can just pull up his essential quote, he said, "How can Manhattan be a cultural or literary center of the world when the number of bookstores has become so insignificant?" And that sentiment has really been echoed a lot since the story has run.
Yeah, I remember on the Upper West Side, I was astonished to realize that our New York Times story about the death of Eeyore's, which was one of the big children's bookstores of the Upper West Side, ran in 1993, that it's been over 20 years since there was a dedicated bookstore for children on the Upper West Side. And there is nothing on the East Side at all for children.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, I mean, we've gotten some incredible comments from readers online from the story. And a lot of people have pointed out that in other countries, in France, in Germany, there are actually laws that make it a lot easier for bookstores to thrive. In France, it is illegal to discount a book more than 5%.
Yes.
Online booksellers are allowed to have free delivery, which has actually been incredibly damaging to some bookstores there. But when you go to Paris, there are bookstores everywhere. When you go to Berlin, you can't walk two blocks without running into a bookstore because in Germany, it is illegal to discount a book past the list price.
Well,
so the publisher sets the price, and that, you know, makes it a very level playing field. So, you know, some people have said, look, this is just the way that it goes. You know, if bookstores can't afford to be in Manhattan, then they can't afford to be in
right.
Manhattan. But that we actually do make choices in, you know, the policies that we set and the tax incentives that we offer. So this is not something that just happens because of capitalism. You know,
right.
our government makes choices.
I think that, you know, in the States, it's clear that book publishing is viewed as just another business. It could easily be widgets. And in other cultures, it's seen, other countries, it's seen as part of their culture, part of the cultural heritage and the ongoing artistic community, and therefore seen as more a part of the arts. And the policies differ.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
And we are suffering the consequences. All right. Well, thank you, Julie.
With that depressing report. Thanks.
Bridget Schulte joins us now. Her new book is Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. I wouldn't know anything about that.
Hi.
Thanks for talking to us. So this is a hot topic because it seems like everyone is experiencing this. Why did you decide to write a book, to take the time to write a book about it?
Right. Because it did take time to write this book. You know, honestly, it was a completely accidental book. I'm not very proud to say that.
It happens to many people.
Yeah, and especially, it's really funny when people, when I tell them I've written a book about time and time pressure, people who've known me all my life just sort of roll their eyes because time is something that I've always been really terrible at. I've always been rushing in late and running out the door with my shoes in hand and toothbrush, you know, going off to school in the morning. So if they say you write the book you need to read, maybe that was part of it. It all came about when a time use researcher that I was talking to on a different project for my work at the Washington Post, where I'm a reporter, I was talking to a time use researcher, and he said, you know, you have 30 hours of leisure a week. All women have 30 hours of leisure a week. And I at the time, you know, I'm a full-time working journalist and a very demanding job like many of us have. I have two kids. I was, you know, a hyper over-involved parent like most American mothers are. And, you know, I was trying to keep my house like Martha Stewart and, you know, not quite as good, but, you know, certainly feeling that pressure. And I just said, you're out of your mind. I don't have 30 hours of leisure a week. And he said, yes, you do. Come do a time study with me. I will show you where your leisure is. And it was really from him issuing that challenge and doing the time study with him that led to this entire book project.
Is this the big American time use study? It's a university-based study?
Well, it started out as a university-based study. This was John Robinson, who's at who's been at the University of Maryland for years. And he's really one of the pioneers of time use research in the United States. You know, so when he told me I had 30 hours of leisure, he's somebody you want to listen to. He's a real, they call him Father Time. He's
right.
And after his work sort of gained the field of time use became more acceptable, and now the Bureau of Labor Statistics has this big American time use survey that they do. They release all sorts of fascinating data all the time about.
Yeah, it's interesting how those statistics about how one uses time always tend to surprise us. I'm always shocked about how much Americans watch television a day. And I just think, how do they have time to watch all that TV? Where does that come from?
Well, and that's actually one of the key things that I discovered in the book, you know, because when you think about leisure time, and TV is certainly leisure time, that's sort of the rap on Americans, that we're just, we work all the time and we're these big fat slobs and we come home at the end of the day and just plop down in front of the television. And you know, that is true in part. We work really crazy hours in this country, and that's part of what I explored in the book. And so we are really exhausted and don't have a lot of energy for much else. You know, the Greeks said that leisure was the place where you refresh the soul. And, you know, Bertrand Russell, in his wonderful essay In Praise of Idleness, has talked about how in leisure time we've actually created civilization. The wheel, inventions, discoveries, science, philosophy, the arts, that all flourished in moments when you are not involved in the drudgery or of work or just trying to survive. That comes in times when, kind of time out of time, when you're able to kind of think differently or see different connections,
right,
let your mind wander. And we really don't have that kind of time in the United States, and we don't value that kind of time anymore. But the other thing that's important about TV watching is that most of us aren't just watching television, particularly mothers and women. When you look at the studies that look at multitasking, most everybody, and particularly women, they have the television on as almost like wallpaper, background noise, and you're cooking dinner, you're paying the bills, you're folding the laundry, you're doing a million other things,
right,
not just vegging out.
So multitasking kind of, when we see all those, you know, those statistics that say these people spend X number of hours doing this and X number of hours doing that, it doesn't add up to a 24-hour day because we're doing things simultaneously.
That's right. When John Robinson gave me the template to track my time, well, first of all, I discovered that my time was sort of everything bled into everything else, and I was doing so many things at once, I had to add my own category, and I called it doing anything else. And I think now they do track that, and different researchers look at different things. But both men and women, there have been more modern studies that have found both men and women multitask. Men tend to multitask at work, so they're multitasking between different work functions. But women multitask between work and home and all sorts of different home functions. So the studies are finding that women are feeling more stressed, more time pressure, and more unhappy with that multitasking.
It's funny because at home, it often seems men will say, you know, do you want me to do X or Y? And the answer is, both, plus this.
Well, and that's another really important point that I discovered as well, that women are still doing not only twice the housework and childcare on average, even though men are doing more, but that women are still primarily in charge. They're still kind of seen as the default parent or the logistics coordinator. So like when you say, you know, when the man asks, what should I do, or I'll do this or that, it's still very much in a, you know, kind of a delegation role. And that doesn't free up this wonderful description they talked about, social scientists talk about contaminated time. So when you're always in charge and you're having to delegate, and since that's particularly women, what that does, it contaminates your time because you've got all this what they call mental labor going on.
Right.
You're trying to keep track of what you're doing and everybody else is doing so that you could even be in a moment that looks like leisure on the outside but doesn't feel like leisure. It's really polluted.
It's the secret remember to remind time.
Exactly. It's the post-it note on the forehead time.
So this is, again, as I mentioned at the beginning, this is something that many of us feel, many of us have talked about. And also there have been a number of books about it. What sort of new here, or what point did you want to make that you felt like hadn't been made?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the classic in this field, of course, is Arlie Hochschild.
Right, The Second Shift.
The Second Shift. That was a groundbreaking classic. That was back in the 1980s. And guess what? Not a whole lot has changed since then. Another classic in the field is Juliet Shore, The Overworked American, talking about the increase in work hours and the decline of leisure. Well, guess what? That's just continued. Those trends of more overwork and diminished leisure have continued to increase. So in terms of what's new here, I'm sad to say that there isn't a whole lot that's new. We already know this is happening.
Right.
And what's new is the fact of, it's like, why? Why is this still happening, and what's the cost? And I suppose that's what's new, is really looking at now this very prolonged decades of a situation that we all knew was unfair and unsustainable. And now we've had several decades of this. And what is the cost to our workplaces, the quality of work that we're doing, our relationships with our spouses, partners, and children, community and family, and to ourselves, and the sense of our, not only our health and our mental well-being, you know, but our souls, really, and our sense of leisure and play and fun and happiness.
So whose fault is it? I have to ask that, you know, as someone who does have small children, that's always often the bottom line question.
Right. Who's to blame, and where do we point the finger?
Right.
Well, and it's a complicated question, and I think that's why I started out on this journey to look for these 30 hours of leisure that I supposedly had, that John Robinson, when he looked through my time diary, he did find 27 hours of what he called leisure, and I called bits and scraps of garbage time. You know, so I wanted to find, you know, well, where's my 30 hours of this soul-refreshing, you know, Greek philosopher time? And I very quickly discovered that you can't look at leisure without looking at the workplace,
mm-hmm.
and you can't look at the workplace without looking at what's happening at home, and that both of those really impact the sense of leisure and playtime, that they're also interconnected. So there's no one place to point a finger, but there are several places that are the culprits that we need to look at. And one is the fact that our lives have changed completely. What women do, our roles in society, on the one hand, have changed utterly, and the world has yet to catch up. Our workplace cultures, our laws and policies are still very much stuck in amber, as if no one has a family or somebody is at home taking care of everything. And that's true not only in the policies and laws, but also in the cultures. When you look at surveys that have been done of bosses and top managers, almost three-fourths of them or more will say the best workers either have no families or no family responsibilities. So our workplaces are very much stuck in an old, rigid notion of what a good worker is. Flexible work is seen as you're not as committed if you're going to do that, even though we have all these wonderful technological innovations that would enable us to work in a different way. We still very much value FaceTime in the office, early, come in early, stay late, regardless of what the performance data shows. The second thing you have to look at is, again, our roles have changed you know, in terms of what women can do in education and work, and yet at home, they really haven't moved much at all.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is because the workplace expects men in particular to work like they always have. So women are left with the double burden, just as Arlie Huxtable pointed out. But men who want to now, say particularly younger men who want to be more involved at home, they're actually more punished than
right.
women are for trying to work in a different way. They're seen as not as committed or smart or even wimpy. That's really important to see. And the last thing is, the other culprit is our own sort of sense of status and how
yes.
we show importance. And instead of showing importance by leisure and the interesting things we do or the thoughts that we have, we show our status by the laundry list of stuff that we cram into our calendars that we can brag about.
Right. I mean, it seems that I was going to say that we've upped the ante in terms of what our expectations are, because it's not just sort of benign neglect with the children while sort of heating up Campbell's soup, but it's, you know, artisanal pickling while creating, you know, perfect objects of Ivy League applicants. So
you have hit the nail on the head. I've got a whole chapter that I looked at that, because I found myself totally caught up in that without even thinking about it. It's like, why am I baking these cupcakes at 2 a.m? And, you know, why am I bringing the Thanksgiving turkey? Why am I here at 10 a.m. laminating for all of the teachers when I really should be at work? You know, why am I trying to act like I'm a stay-at-home mother, but more than a stay-at-home mother? I was feeling like I had to do more than my own mother did. And that was a fascinating thing to see, that the social scientists who study motherhood and mothering trends say that the gap has never been wider now between what we consider the ideal mother and the reality of what we're able to do. And that blew me away, that the time studies that show that working mothers, I mean, for years we were always told sort of in the popular press that working mothers were abandoning their children. But in fact, they're spending as much or more time with their children than stay-at-home mothers did in the 60s and 70s, and it's more interactive, intense time. You know, the 60s or 70s, it was go out and play until the streetlights come on and don't let the screen door hit you on the rear end.
Right.
And now it's much more, like you're saying, reading and taking to the museums and, you know, talking and thinking great thoughts and right, grooming them for the college application that will be 18 years down the road.
All right. Well, those listeners who have been quietly scrapbooking while listening to this or perfecting their poached eggs from the chickens raised in their backyard, we will now let you go back and concentrate on those tasks. Bridget, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Bridget Schulte, author of Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. Greg Coles joins us with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, some familiar names on the hardcover fiction list. Actually, there's a whole lot of new titles, and every one of them written by somebody who's been here before. That's the way things go often on the fiction list. A lot of brand names, starting at number 16 with the series fantasy writer R.A. Salvatore, whose new book is Night of the Hunter. That's new on the list at number 16. At number 15, Jean Hanf Korelitz, who wrote the book Admission that got turned into that Tina Fey movie. She has a new novel out called You Should Have Known. Sort of a thriller, really, from Korelitz.
Set in the world of therapy.
Yeah, yes, it is. It's about a couples counselor whose own husband turns out to be not quite what she had thought he was. Then at number 13... Olin Steinhauer, another thriller, has a novel called The Cairo Affair.
That was reviewed last week by James McBride.
James McBride reviewed that for us. Yes, he did. Then at number 12, you may remember last summer, Ian Dosher had kind of a quirky bestseller called William Shakespeare's Star Wars, which retold the whole story of Star Wars in iambic pentameter. He has now followed that up, unsurprisingly, with William Shakespeare's The Empire Striketh Back. And his intention, he told me last year, was to go through the series Star Wars Part 4, Part 5, Part 6, the first three movies that came out, and he will not do, I think, the prequels.
So we can't look forward to Jar Jar Binks in Iambic Pentameter.
No, I don't think we'll see William Shakespeare's Jar Jar Binks. Then at number 11, Joel C. Rosenberg. Do you know who that is?
He's not
a conservative political pundit, communications strategist. He's an evangelical Christian. He writes commentaries for the New Review and other things. But he's also a thriller writer who often kind of brings his religion into his books. This is his first, as far as I can tell, his first historical thriller. It's called The Auschwitz Escape, and it looks at a French pastor helping a Jew escape from Auschwitz. Together, their intention is to spread the word about the Holocaust and the Nazis' plans to take over the world. All the way up at number two, Terry Pratchett continues his long-running Discworld series. He's a British author. This series has run since 1983. One of the interesting things about Pratchett is the fact that he's still writing at all, because in 2007, he announced that he had early onset Alzheimer's disease, and he was only going to continue this series as long as he was able. But apparently he's still able, and the new novel in the Discworld series is called Raising Steam. That's new at number two. Finally, there is a new number one title on the hardcover fiction list this week. It is Harlan Coben's Missing You.
And he, of course, did a by-the-book interview with us last week, in which he extolled, among other things, many women writers.
Well, Harlan Coben is very popular among women readers, and he's been a big fan of kind of the domestic suspense novel.
His book, of course, Tell No One, which was turned into a French movie, was in many ways as much a love story as it was a thriller.
That takes us through hardcover fiction, and as I said, a lot of familiar authors new on that list. On the nonfiction side of things, there are just three new books this week. Also from some familiar authors and one less familiar. Starting at number nine, Simon Shama, a previous bestseller and previous guest on the podcast this week, returns with The Story of the Jews. Of course, it's accompanied by the PBS series, The Story of the Jews. And this volume just looks at the story of the Jews, the first 2,500 years. It brings it up right to 1492, kind of the start of the New World.
A few things to come.
Yeah. Then at number seven, the conservative commentator and Fox News Channel host, Greg Gutfeld, has a book out called Not Cool, which looks at the phenomenon of the hipster and says, actually, they're not that cool. it's kind of a...
Or not cool at all.
Exactly. Gutfeld is about my age, so I'll call him a young man. He's kind of, this book, he's positioning himself as sort of a grumpy young man, saying all these young kids these days. He's not finding a lot to like there. And then the new name on the list this week is Adam Braun. He is an entrepreneur and a nonprofit entrepreneur. He started a foundation that creates schools in the developing world and has written a book called The Promise of a Pencil. It's sort of a three cups of tea kind of a deal. He worked on Wall Street and was on a trip to India, and he asked a child begging there, well, what can I get for you? What would really help you out? And the boy said, a pencil would really help me out. And Adam Braun thought, wow, you know, it takes so little then to bring a lot of change to these kids' world. And so he started with like $25 and built it into eventually a foundation that has created more than 200 schools around the world. So that book, which he wrote with Carly Adler, is new at number two on the list this week.
All right. Well, a lovely thing to top the news for bestsellers. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.